So thank you for inviting me here. We heard throughout these 2 days about this exciting event. We learned new stuff about what we saw, what we think we saw, and what we think created the thing that we think that we saw. We heard about models and shock breakouts and jets, structure jets. Let's not mention that. I promise not to mention that. What I want to discuss now is what is happening to the jet before it breaks out and how we get to the point where the jet is accumulated, the energy it has, how the cocoon is built, and how all these events lead to the emission that we see. I'm going to discuss it in the context of MHD jets, and there is a parallel work that was done by Orr, Udi, about hydrodynamic jets that is published in a poster outside. So the event that the gamma ray burst events that accompanied the GW170817 had characteristics that were similar to short gamma ray burst. It appeared about 2 seconds after the merger. It has a duration of 2 seconds, as we heard in the talk of Veres, and with an initial peak, which was relatively hard, followed by a later peak, which was much softer. As when Feist told us that the galaxy, the host galaxy of this event, is an elliptical galaxy, very low star formation rate, a very old population of stars, sort of what you expect in the case of a short gamma ray burst, so things are done. The problem is that it has also several other features that did not put it at a regular gamma ray, short gamma ray burst case. For example, the isotropic equivalent energy was much lower than what we see in regular short gamma ray bursts. Also, the isotropic equivalent luminosity here in the purple star. Also, the peak energy was much softer, about almost an order of magnitude softer than what we see in regular short gamma ray bursts. And also, the tail, even of the initial hard spike, was much softer than what we see. So this puts it in a, makes it a kind of an unusual short gamma ray burst. The thing is that when you look at the population of long gamma ray bursts, they also have a subpopulation known as low luminosity gamma ray bursts, which show similar features of low energy and very soft spectrum. And it is located here in this plot. And the emission, the gamma ray emission in the low luminosity gamma ray burst population is attributed to a breakout of a mildly relativistic shock from the surface of the star. So if this is the case for the long gamma ray burst, it's very appealing to try to apply this shock breakout model also for this case of peculiar short gamma ray. And that's what motivates the research both in the MHD context and in the hydro context that was led by Orr. So I want to address now the case of the MHD jets. And in order to understand what is going on, let's first start to address the question of how the jet propagates through the ejecta that we know that is already exists there when the jet is launched. So let's take a simple case of a jet that is propagating in a general stationary medium. And when the jet is propagating through the medium, it's pushing the medium ahead of it, forming a structure of an oblique shock that at the top of the jet and a slower moving head because the jet is just pushing the medium like a piston. Now, matter that crosses this shock is getting heated up and forms a cocoon around the jet. And this cocoon is highly pressurized, and it collimates the jet into a narrow shape. Now, the pressure in the cocoon in the case of a stationary media is relatively uniform in the z direction, and the total energy is comparable or even larger than the actual energy of the jet, depending on the jet propagation velocity. In this case, the cocoon will create a jet with a cylindrical shape, and if the jet is also magnetically dominated, then the magnetic energy is transported outward by the magnetic fields. When it reaches the edge, it flows into the cocoon, and basically the magnetic field lines that are returning back to the source are dead field lines. They don't carry any energy. All the energy that was carried by the jet was dumped into the jet and into the jet ahead, and from there it moved into the cocoon. So this is the general picture of how MHD jet propagate. Now, how do you create this jet in the first place? So creating MAG jet is quite simple. The best mechanism that we know how to create this jet is somewhat resembled to the Blanford-Znaik process. A simple version of that that I show here is take a conducting sphere, put a poloidal field line, put a field line that is connected to this sphere. Since the sphere is conducting, when you start to rotate it, the field line is basically anchored to the surface and starts to rotate with the sphere. So in this case, you start to wind the magnetic field lines and you create a toroidal component to the field and an electrical field that is in the theta direction that is there because of the Maxwell equations. So now the property of the toroidal field crossed with the electric field gives you a pointing flux that is directed outward along the poloidal field lines. And this pointing flux carry basically the rotational energy of the central object in the form of electromagnetic wave along the poloidal field lines and outward. And this is basically the powering mechanism of the jet. Now, if you put a jet in a vacuum, what happens is that when you wind the magnetic field lines, the pointing flux is will propagating outwards on radial trajectories. Now, if you put them, if there is a matter around that jet, it will block the free expansion of the magnetic field. And what will happen is that since the central part continue to rotate, you continue to build up toroidal pressure, and toroidal pressure has a sort of a tension in it, like a rubber band that you expand. And it, when you build enough toroidal pressure, this tension, which is known as hoop stress, will produce an inward pressure that will take the radial poloidal field lines and collimate them along the axis. And then what will happen is that the pointing flux will start to condense into a smaller and smaller area, producing a larger and larger ram pressure, and eventually it will manage to punch through the medium, creating the narrow jet. As the jet continues to propagate, it's creating its own cocoon that is embedded, that is bounded by this bow shock at the head of the jet. And the cocoon will keep the jet, continue to keep the jet narrow. Within the properties of both stellar interior and also within the properties of the ejecta that we know that is around the short gamma ray burst that we saw, the jet propagates at a mildly, at the sub to mildly relativistic velocity, and the cocoon energy is somewhat is comparable to the energy in the jet. Relativistic matter, the magnetic matter that flows along the jet path, is pushed at the head to the sideways, creating an inner part of the an inner part of the cocoon that is magnetized, and an outer part that is non-magnetized. Now, the inner magnetized part is the shocked jet medium, while the outer part is the shocked external medium that passes through the bow shock. And the properties of the cocoon, there is a pressure balance, between these two parts, the jet, the inner cocoon, and the outer cocoon in the lateral direction that keeps them together. Now, the properties of this cocoon is critically depend on the mixing between these two parts, which unfortunately in the MHD regime, we still are unable to quantify it very well. The only leading thing is that it is likely to be less efficient than mixing in hydrodynamic jet because magnetic fields tend to inhibit mixing. The shape of the cocoon as the jet continues to propagate will be dictated by the properties of the ambient medium. In this case, where you have an ambient medium which is stationary, the jet is relatively narrow and the cocoon has a shape that is much wider than the jet itself. If we move to a moving ejecta, now we're switching from a stationary medium into a moving ejecta. This is the ejecta that is that we think that is surrounding the merger of the two neutron stars, and this is the jet that is propagating inward. Then the moving ejecta will allow the jet to expand more to the side, creating a wider jet. As you can see it here, the field lines, these are the poloidal field lines that are coming out and returning at the head. So the jet boundary is somewhere around here. This is the inner cocoon, while this is the outer cocoon. You can see that it is much narrower. Now, the jet continues to propagate upward until it reaches the edge of this of the ejecta. And as it's reaching the edge of the ejecta, it will break out. Now, when it breaks out, it will want to expand sideways. However, both the jet and the cocoon are breaking out together. Therefore, you are keep, as the jet expands and accelerates, the cocoon is expanding with it and keeps it sort of preventing it from expanding too much sideways. And what in this case of the short gamma ray burst, what we're getting is a jet with an opening angle of about 20 degrees, and it is bounded by the inner cocoon that is unable to expand too much sideways due to the hoop stress of the magnetic field lines that have dominated the inner part, and it is the outer part of the cocoon that is not magnetized that it is able to expand sideways. Okay, so you get sort of a stratified structure of the jet where you have an inner jet surrounded by an inner cocoon, surrounded by the outer cocoon. Now, leading to all this structure, we have the bow shock, the shock that bounded the cocoon, that is break out before all this structure breaks out. It comes out from an optically thin to an optically thick, from an optically thick to an optically thin medium, and it should radiate before the jet will radiate by itself. Now, before I will continue, I want to discuss a little bit about the radiation properties of a shock breaking out from an optically thick medium, because it will be important in order to understand how the emission from this system will look like. So now we're moving out to a short discussion about shock breakout emission, which is based on a seminal paper by Udnakar and Ramsari from 2010 and 2012. So what is a shock breakout? A shock breakout is a shock that is transiting from an optically thick to an optically thin medium. As it propagating in the optically thick medium, it is mediated by radiation that is unable to escape. And when it moves into the optically thin medium, the radiation will be able to escape. Now, as it moves, the medium behind the shock is hot. It is filled with photons before it reaches the optically thin medium. And it moves with the velocity that is roughly equivalent to the velocity of the shock. Now, radiation inside this layer is trapped, and it moves at the velocity, it basically diffuses outward, and it moves with the velocity that it is roughly comparable to the speed of light divided by the optical depth. You can see that the optical depth from the surface. So you can see that as you move closer and closer to the surface, this velocity is becoming larger and larger. So there is a surface from which these photons that are propagating have a velocity that is equal to the velocity of the moving layer. Photons that are located on this surface will be able to escape because as they're propagating outward, they accelerate and become faster than the velocity of the layer. So these photons will be able to escape as the shock moves from optically thin to optically thick. From optically thick to optically thin medium. This comparison between the velocity of the photons and the velocity of the shock gives you a condition about the minimal optical depth from which photons will be able to escape. And this condition is that tau is equal to C over V that you probably heard for so many times when people are talking about shock breakouts. So this is the reason why it's coming from. Now, this will give you also a typical thickness to the layer, which is just 1 over the beta of the shock times the density times the opacity. If we want to calculate the typical temperature that the photon that is emitting from this shock, you need to remember that as the velocity becomes mildly relativistic, the photons don't have a lot of scatterings to do before they escape. So they don't have time to thermalize. So these photons that escape from this layer, however, they are in kinetic equilibrium with the electrons there. So the typical energy, so the temperature that will you observe is basically the typical energy of the photons, which is just the kinetic energy of the electrons minus their rest mass energy. The total energy that will be emitted from this shock is just the volume of this layer, which is 4 pi r squared times the thickness of the layer, times the energy density, times the boosting as the shock is moving at mildly relativistic velocity. You may notice that there are two factors of gamma here. This factor is the Lorentz factor of the shock, and this is the Lorentz factor of the shock layer relative to the observer. If the ejecta is stationary, these two Lorentz factors are the same, basically, because the ejecta and the observer are both stationary. However, if we are in a situation where we have a moving ejecta, such in the case of the short gamma reverse, the story is a little bit different. Now, the place where the shock will break out from, the tau equal 1, is moving at the velocity, at this case I chose a velocity of 0.8c, and the shock that is still in the optically thick region is trailing this, this front, and it will reach it at a radius which is roughly the time when the when we started the shock, which is basically the onset of the jet, divided by 1 over beta of the ejecta, which gives us, in these parameters, it gives us a radius of a few times 10 to the 11 centimeters. In this case, the Lorentz factor of the shock should be measured comparable to the ejecta rest frame, and this will give us a much lower Lorentz factor to the shock, and therefore the shock will be weaker. However, the boosting will still be the actual velocity of the shock layer compared to the observer, which is Lorentz factor of 3. Now, if you place these parameters in the equation that I showed you before, what you get is that the total energy that is, can be radiated from these types of shock is on the order of 10 to the 46 ergs within these parameters, which is on the ballpark of what we actually see in this event. Another thing is that the temperature, I told you that we'll not see a thermal temperature because the photons don't have time to thermalize. The peak energy will be roughly on the scale of about 150 keV. The time when these two layers catch up to each other, which is the onset of the emission, will be about 1.5 seconds after the onset of the jet, and the duration over which this event will last is roughly the scale of the layer divided by the Lorentz factor, which is the relativistic shrinking, and this will give you about 0.5 seconds. Now, this is just the first stage, because this layer now continue to accelerate outwards, and it will continue to radiate. Now, as we accelerate outward, we separate two different stages. In the first stage, when the layer is still does not double its radius, the layer does not feel that it is part of a whole sphere. And therefore, the emission can be treated as it's coming from a 1D normal shock. In this situation, what is happening is that in the case of the ejecta, what is happening is that the scale over which the hydrodynamic properties change, the scale over which the shock accelerates, are much larger than the actual scale of the layer. In this case, we can treat the layer as it have a uniform density, roughly, and a uniform pressure. And this type of layer, as it accelerates, it does not expand because it doesn't have a pressure gradient. So as it accelerates upward, as time prolongs, photons from deeper and deeper layer have time to diffuse outward, and therefore the actual layer that radiates is somewhat larger. It's larger by a factor of a few than this delta R that we calculate at the breakout stage itself. However, these photons still undergo a small number of scattering, so they don't have time to thermalize. So the emission that we see will actually be a composite emission from photons from layers of optical depth of a few, and the typical spectrum will be non-thermal with the peak energy, which is roughly at the ballpark of this 150 keV. When the layer has doubled its radius, it starts to feel that it is part of a sphere. They start to feel the curvature. And as it continues to expand, the density now drops. As the density drops, the optical depth drops, and photons from deeper and deeper layer are now have easier time to diffuse. Now, these photons are diffused from layer which are actually colder. Why colder? Because when the shock passes them before it reached the edge, it has a slower velocity, so that's why they are colder. So photons from the deeper layer is actually softer, and these photons has time to thermalize. So the spectrum during the spherical phase will be more thermal and much more softer. So in a shock breakout situation, we expected to see a transition from a non-thermal hard part into a more thermal, softer part, sort of a blue to red transition. So now let's go back to the situation of the jet breaking out from the star. Now, we talked about what is happening in the jet as it propagating through the star when it is magnetized. We talked about, we understand that there is a shock that is that should be break out, and we understand how the emission from this shock should look like. Let's try to put this together into a single model, and in this model, I use 2D MHD simulation in order to simulate how the jet propagates and break out from this dynamical ejecta. The background ejecta, the boundary condition that I used, is an ejecta with velocity profile that is taken from Kenta's simulations of neutron star merger, where we added a fast tail at the head of the ejecta, which moved at a velocity of about 0.8 c. As we heard earlier today, there are actually indications that this very fast part of the ejecta do exist in numerical simulation that we are able now to see. So there is actually a physical motivation to use this tail in the simulation. At the center of this ejecta, I placed a dipole field that is connected to a sphere, and to create a jet, all I did was starting the rotation of the sphere, and this creating a jet, a magnetized jet, that is start to push through the ejecta as the ejecta is expanding.
Just one question, what's the strength of the magnetic field that you consider?
This?
Yep.
So, the magnetic field was actually normalized to give a jet with sort of a regularish power of a short gamma ray burst, about 10 to the 49 Hertz per second or something like that, isotropically equivalent. So as the jet propagates, you can start seeing propagating through the ejecta. After 1 second, it breaks out from the ejecta core into the fast-moving tail and continue to propagate. After 2 seconds, we basically shut off the engine. So all the energy was injected in the first 2 seconds, and the actual breakout from the fast-moving tail is occurring after about 6 seconds in the lab frame. An observer will look will see this breakout at a much shorter time because of the relativistic time contraction, to remind you. Now, this is how the jet and the cocoon looks like at the moment of the breakout. This is the inner part of the jet with an opening angle of about 20 degrees. This is the inner cocoon that surrounded the magnetized part, and this is the non-magnetized part that it is able to expand sideways over a much larger opening angle than the actual opening angle of the jet. You can see here in this image of the sigma parameter that this is where the jet energy is located. All this part is basically dead part that fills the cavity once the engine stopped injecting the power. To analyze the properties of this cocoon, what we did is that we sliced this image into pie chart, which each pie slice has an opening angle of about 10 degrees. And within each slice, what we did is we measured the amount of energy that we have per unit of logarithmic for velocity. That it will give us it will give us an understanding how exactly the energy is divided within the velocity beams. What we're looking for is we're looking for enough energy in the fast-moving part that will give us the shock breakout. So this graph is showing you that the red and the orange lines represent the innermost 10 and 20 degrees, which are basically the jet. And over here, not surprisingly, most of the energy is located within the faster part of the ejecta. This is logarithmic. So this is gamma beta of about 10. And actually, I don't show what happened at gamma beta of larger than that. And most of the energy in the jet is actually located here in the region where the Lorentz factor is very high. The interesting part is the blue line. The blue line is the region between 20 to 30 degrees, which is where the cocoon resides. Within this part, what you see is that we have roughly a flat distribution of energy per logarithmic velocity. And a lot of the energy is located within Lorentz factor of about 3 to 5, if you want. And this energy is the important one. This is the leading part of the cocoon that will give you the shock breakout, and this energy is what will be able to radiate and reach the observer in the form of gamma ray photons. Now, or went ahead and took the output from this simulation and produced synthetic light curve. What you see here are how the light curve of the event will seem to observer at different opening angles. This is 30, 35, and 40 degrees. And you see that there is a delay of between 1 to 2 seconds from the merger to the onset of the event, and that the duration of the event lasts roughly 2 seconds. Again, here we did not try to fit the result to the observed parameters, because when I did this model, I did not have access to the actual observed parameters because it was under embargo. But you see that we're definitely within the right ballpark. Another thing that Orr did is produced a synthetic spectrum, which is integrated in the first 3.7 seconds and in the later 3.7 seconds, which is roughly the window that the Fermi team did in order to divide the spectrum from early to late times. And you see that at early time, the spectrum is much bluer, and it is non-thermal, and this spectrum is dominated by the thermal, planar non-thermal phase of the shock breakout. At later times, the spectrum is becoming softer, much more thermal, and well, not thermal, because we still have the bump of the planar phase in this case. However, still the spectrum is much softer, and you do see this transition, this very defined transition between blue to red, which is very very characteristic to a shock breakout. In the last 5 minutes, I will quickly go through alternative models to the event that actually Conejito already mentioned. I will just mention briefly some and add a little bit more details to a bit more quantification to this. If we want this event to become an on-axis jet, we need the jet to be very, very weak in order to account for the weak isotropical equivalent energy. Actually, if you assume a jet of about 10 degrees, you get a power of about 10 to the 44 arcs per second. This type of jet will take about 15 seconds to break from the ejector that we think that we see, which basically means that the jet will never be able to break out. So the only way out is either use very low mass on the ejector, which is inconsistent with what we see in the macronova, or a much more powerful jet, which is inconsistent with what we see in the Lorentz factor. If we are looking at off-axis jets, then we need a boosting. If you think the jet is an off-axis jet and we want it to be boosted into a regular short gamma ray burst, it means that the boosting should be about 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 6 to the actual isotropic equivalent energy that we see. In this case, if we want to maintain since there is a dependency which goes like gamma to times the off-axis theta to the power of 4, it means that the boosting also in the Lorentz factor give us a limit to the maximal size of the off-axis angle that we see. And actually, the larger the boosting, we need also larger Lorentz factor in order to avoid compactness issues. And in all these cases, what we get is a limit of about 0.1 radian. Now, in this case, such a small sideways angle means that the afterglow that we will see from the main event, that we don't see it in gamma ray bursts, will be very bright, unless the medium density is very low. And another thing is that not only that the isotropic equivalent energy is boosted, is also that the peak energy is boosted. And with this parameters, the peak energy that an online observer will see will be about 10 MeV. So if we want this jet to be, this event to be an off-axis jet, it means that the on-axis jet is highly irregular jet. It is highly irregular. It is located in a highly irregular environment, and the jet itself is very, very hard. So that makes this situation somewhat less convenient to us, because it's definitely not a normal, regular short gamma ray burst. Thank you. Let's cross this word. Let's call it I don't know, composite jets or something. Just a few words about that. If indeed the jet has this, these wings which are have a low Lorentz factor, and we're viewing this wing on axis, okay, we're off axis on the main jet, but we're on axis on the wings, then it means that these wings need to be very low power. Now, I don't want to comment about the actual propagation. What I do want to flash is that remember that the jet is surrounded by a cocoon with an energy that is equivalent to the actual energy of the jet. So any low power wing must be squashed by this cocoon, and we're back in the situation where we're actually observing the cocoon and not a structured jet. If we're observing this structured jet from the side and we want to use a moderate boosting, not bring this wings to become too powerful, we're in a situation where the power of these wings will become a little bit uncomfortable in the way that we will be able to observe such wing also from regular short gamma ray bursts. If this was the situation, what we would have observed, we would expect to see short gamma ray bursts from this direction, and in this case, these short gamma ray bursts will reveal us the afterglow of the main event that is happening at a delay, and it will contain energy that is larger than the energy of the jet that we see. So this signature of a lower energy cocoon is something that we do not observe in short gamma ray bursts. So it means that it is unlikely that there is this a structured jet that is observed by the short gamma ray bursts. Last, I just want to make a comment that we don't have to have this successful jet breaking out from the cocoon. We can have a situation where the jet is actually failing and it's only the cocoon breaking out. This will give us a similar signature. This situation is relatively easy to get in a hydrodynamic case because all you need to do is inject a very wide-angle jet, or it's much harder to reach in the case of a magnetized jet because of the tendency of the jet to collimate because of the hoop stress. So it is, if we'll be able to rule out the situation of even a weak jet that broke out, maybe it will tell us something about the type of the engine that it is ejecting the jet. Radio emission can be used to discriminate different models, as we heard in previous talks. And I will leave you to the conclusions. And thank you very much.
Possibility to make a mildly relativistic shock breakout. One is the acceleration of the shock during the propagation in the ejector tail. The other is an incomplete mixing of shock to jet and shock to ejector. So in the hydrodynamical case, the former mechanism may be the essential. But how about in your magnetized case?
You want what you want basically is that the shock will be continued pushed by the inner part of the cocoon. Are you envisioning a situation where you have an active jet or an inactive jet? Because if you have an active jet, the jet will give you all the energy that you need, and the shock will break out. Most of the energy of the shock breakout will come in the upper, let's say, 30 degrees or something.
My question is failed jet case.
In the failed jet case. So in the failed jet case, the problem in the failed jet case is that you need the jet to fail high enough within the ejector, so you don't need, so you won't have to swipe too much material, otherwise it will kill your shock acceleration. So in this case, I think both mechanisms can work equally.
Okay. So can you go back to the motivational slides for the first slide?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So I will not do it like this.
So you may be right that this is a special GRB or isn't a GRB at all, but if you look at the plot, so the orange ones are the short GRBs that have redshift and thus luminosity determination. this is the first GRB that was associated with a gravitational wave. So in that respect, it's special, and it has some kind of bias. We would have never followed this type of GRB up.
True.
Because the GBM has
true
really large error radius. So mm-hmm.
Remember that this was exactly the situation when we started to detect the low luminosity gamma ray bursts. 98 BW was would have been considered as completely ordinary long gamma ray burst until we started to understand that there are special circumstances, for example, the very short proximity that it was shown.
The story is a bit different because low luminosity long GRBs were swift detected, and swift has really good positional accuracy, mm-hmm. while we don't. Mm-hmm. So my question is, so if these are really special types of GRBs, mm-hmm. How far up in luminosity would your model be able to explain it?
So if the luminosity that we observed, the few times 10 to the 36 ergs, that is, let's say it's a typical type of luminosity, then we should observe them, the isotropic equivalent energy is about 10 to the 47 ergs. You should be able to observe them at a few hundred megaparsecs.
Okay.
The question was, could you observe much higher energy EISO versions of this mechanism?
So say, do they exist, basically?
So
say we observe one that is similar and it's 10 times more luminous.
Yeah, you need to have it breaking out from a much larger radius with this typical Lorentz factor, maybe, but you need a much larger energy for that. And then the problem with short gamma ray bursts is that we were in short supply of the actual energy. So,
regarding the peak, the spectral peak of the GRB from the breakout, Umar, can you clarify the temperature behind the shock? I saw the formula that you wrote. The temperature behind it sets the spectral peak, right? So the temperature is the electron rest mass times basically the energy of upstream electrons. Is it how you estimate it?
No, it's the kinetic energy of the upstream electron as across the shock minus the rest mass.
Sure. So this why is it electron mass? Most of the energy is sitting in the ions, right?
Yeah, but the photons are in kinetic equilibrium with the electrons.
Yes,
right?
But so the energy, the temperature is set by the energy that comes through the shock. And so the flux of energy is carried by the pre-shock ions. And then something happens to it. It's given to photons and electrons. Mm-hmm. What's the meaning of the
photon? They're giving you this energy. It's not because the perturbation by the photon will set the energy to be for every gamma shock which is high enough. This formula is not exactly accurate.
I just don't get the meaning. But it happens to be an approximation.
No, it's happened to be a good approximation when gamma shock is mildly relativistic. That's it.
Yeah, but that's the case that I'm talking about.
Any other questions?
Omar, I was curious about the, you mentioned the magnetized and non-magnetized inner and outer cocoon. There's something interesting happening. Could you elaborate?
So if you look in the case of a hydrodynamic jet, this part of the inner cocoon is basically the shock jet medium, which is light and hot. And this part of the outer cocoon is shock stellar or shock ejecta. Okay, and there is a mixture between these two that, according to the simulation that was done by Orr, it gives you energy per specific enthalpy of about one, if you want. However, in the case of magnetic jet, it is not clear that the mixture will be very efficient, because magnetic fields tends to inhibit any growth of Rayleigh-Taylor or Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. In this case, it is reasonable to assume that the inner part will maintain a relatively large specific enthalpy, And therefore, when the jet will break out, we may be able to observe a different radiation emission signature from the inner part of the cocoon if it's magnetized, than in the case of a hydrodynamic jet when it is not magnetized and mixed. For example, this part will accelerate to larger Lorentz factors because its specific enthalpy is larger. So in this case, after the breakout, there may be a way to distinguish between a hydrodynamic versus a magnetic jet.
So there's a question in the back, Duncan, but I'll ask a quick question. So I know you've worked on dissipation of magnetic energy by instabilities. I'm curious if you can comment on, in this situation, given what we think we know about the ejecta and the jet properties, whether or not the jet is likely to be kink unstable and how important that could be as a heating mechanism.
Okay. So first of all, I do expect to have dissipation over here in this part where the magnet. These are 2D simulations, so you don't see any kink growing. But in the 3D case, when you have this contraction into this type of a nozzle, you should have kink, internal kink modes that will grow and give you a dissipation of a considerable fraction of the magnetic field. However, as the jet continues to propagate outward, you see that it starts to become much wider than in the case of propagation in a stationary medium. This type of jet will tend to be more stable to kink instability than jet in stars. So I don't expect the upper part of the jet to be very widely kink unstable as in the case of a star. And that's what motivates me to settle at the moment for the 2D simulation, because I don't think that the 3D simulation will be different kinetically. However, there will be a difference in the amount of the magnetization inside the jet. In the case of 3D, I would expect to have less magnetization, or if you want, the beta parameter will be larger in the case of in the 3D than in the case of the 2D.
Just a question that I try to understand something that you said. You showed a simulation of a system of a breakout of a jet with a cocoon, which was an MHD simulation, and you said that it lasted about 5 to 6 seconds, but that would be not really what the observer would see because of time contraction. So I'm just curious a little bit about what was the time that you were showing in that simulation. Is it coordinate time?
No, the time that I showed the simulation is the time from the onset of the merger.
Yeah, but in what frame? I'm trying to
In the star frame.
And
not in the observer frame. The observer is sitting. Okay, this is the time that I showed you is the time that the that this layer actually takes to catch up with the edge of the ejecta in the star frame, the center of the star frame. An observer will see this occurring at the time which is, if you want, C over T times 1 minus beta. T times 1 minus beta, or T divided by gamma square.
But also, there is some time that is the one required for whatever initial assumptions you have.
Yes.
That will be there, which we don't know.
Yes, this time I took it to be about half a second. So this is the launching of the jet. There is a delay between the onset of the formation of the central object and the actual launching of the jet. The reason for this delay is when you create your central hot object before it collapses, if we assume that it doesn't collapse directly to a black hole, what's happened initially is that this object is very hot and is very violently cooled by neutrino. So this lifts a very heavy baryonically dominated wind that loads the field line. And as it loads the field lines, it prevents them from collimating and producing the jet. So what you have is roughly a spherical wind that is coming out and collide with the ejecta. With time, as this object cools down, the loading of the field line decreasing, and then your hoop stress becomes active again, and it is able to form the jet. So in this situation, the idea is that this jet is formed at a delay once this neutrino-driven wind starts to settle down.
But also the field lines are initially completely toroidal, and then you have to realign them and make them epoloidal.
Why?
Because you just disrupt the stars. You have a very strong differential rotation. all the initial energy.
Ah, you're talking about a different situation. What you're talking about is the dynamo process that will allow you to have a large-scale colloidal field on the surface of the central object to give you this jet from the first place. I don't handle this situation. I assume that I already had a dynamo process that gave me this large-scale field, and that gives me the jet. How long it takes? I think it should happen on the time scale that it takes you to form the jet. To form the central object. Otherwise, there is no point in launching a magnetically dominated jet. How it happens, I do not know.
Just another quick question about the spectrum still. I'm obsessed with the spectrum.
Okay.
So you have 150 kV temperature, and
yes.
Then it's in kinetic equilibrium. So talking about wind spectrum. So
yes, it's a wind spectrum.
Wind spectrum.
Yes.
So wind peaks at 3 times kT. And so the peak would be at 150 times 3, and then you multiply it by gamma of 3. Is it how you calculate the peak? Or because then it becomes a bit high, right?
Wait. So this is actually a toy model, okay? What the thing that you want to look at is the actual calculation, which Orr did, and these spectra are actually calculated from the breakout time of the shock as it passes through the planar and the spherical phase. And this is an integration of the all the phases with the actual calculation of what the temperature should be. So this is the thing that you see. Actually, you do see that the peak energy is larger than 150 keV. Actually, this one is at about, let's say, something 500 or 600 keV. So this is, yeah, so this is pretty hard. But again, I did not try to fit the actual observation. It was just a demonstration that these things will give you a hard peak and a soft peak. If you want to start to fit it, you can play with the slope and you can get to a softer and softer situation.
Any last questions, comments? Okay, let's thank Omer again. And in fact, all of the speakers of the session. So I